Welcome to today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, July 6, 2025. In the March 2025 issue of Scientific American, Opinion and Analysis from Scientific American's Board of Editors. Facilitating immigration will fuel innovation. To maintain its competitive edge in science and technology, the U.S. needs to make it easier for foreign-born STEM workers to enter the country. In late December 2024, a social media storm erupted after entrepreneur Elon Musk blasted out support for the iconic H-1B visa. The temporary work visa has long served as a ticket to jobs in the U.S. high-tech industry for skilled foreign-born scientists and engineers. In response, President Trump's nativist backers pushed back immediately. Former Trump advisor Steve Bannon characterized Musk's position as a ploy by tech oligarchs to take jobs from Americans. Headlines proclaimed the outbreak of a MAGA civil war. Musk's remarks might seem self-serving, but he is right in highlighting the need for more engineering talent from overseas. Foreign-born tech workers are essential to fuel America's powerhouse economy, one that captures an outsized percentage of global gross domestic product compared with its population. And they will be key for hiring the more than 1 million additional STEM workers that will be needed in 2033, compared with 2023, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. This increase marks a 10% growth rate, almost three times what is projected for any non-STEM industry during the same period. Immigrants are a big part of what has made America a global leader in science and technology. If Trump's nativist faction prevails and restricts the entry of skilled workers, that will have a profound effect on this leadership role, as well as on the U.S. economy. Closing borders is a mistake. The tech elite knows this. Musk, who was born in South Africa and now heads an advisory committee for the Trump administration called the Department of Government Efficiency, one he has since left, is one of many tech magnates who was born in South Africa and headed an advisory committee for the Trump administration called the Department of Government Efficiency, is one of many tech magnates who rely on the H-1B visa. Musk's Tesla company received approvals for 742 H-1B petitions for new hires during the 2024 federal fiscal year, more than double the number from a year earlier. Amazon, owned by Jeff Bezos, applied for nearly 3,900 H-1Bs in 2024. Most of the 25 companies that made the most H-1B requests in 2024 are technology firms, including Microsoft, Infosys, and Meta, the parent company of Facebook, run by Mark Zuckerberg. Despite the claims from Bannon and other hard-right MAGA supporters that H-1Bs rob American citizens of skilled jobs, the pipeline for domestic talent alone is unlikely to fill looming employment gaps. U.S. math scores have dropped, and the educational infrastructure at the most basic level is often just not there. Only half of U.S. high schools offer calculus, and 60% provide physics classes. Both skills are critical for designing quantum computers and achieving innovations in artificial intelligence. According to study estimates, just 3% or so of America's high school graduates join the ranks of STEM workers. Prominent legislation to promote STEM education has not met its funding targets. The Biden administration's CHIPS, C-H-I-P-S, and Science Act set out to invest billions of dollars in STEM education. But the funding appropriated for the National Science Foundation has been hundreds of millions less than what was originally requested. In addition to industry jobs, the basic and applied research that takes place at the nation's universities and tech hubs is highly reliant on overseas talent. An August 2020 report from the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, the NAS, notes that contributions from the large cadre of international students are critical to sustaining current levels of research in U.S. graduate programs. Foreign-born employees make up 43% of U.S. STEM workers who hold doctoral degrees, and this number rises to nearly 60% in computer science and certain other fields. These professionals bring abundant benefits to the STEM workforce. In 2022, more than half of U.S. startups with valuations greater than $1 billion had at least one immigrant at their helm, and the value of foreign-born professionals in this country can be witnessed on the global stage at the highest levels of human achievement. 40% of American Nobel Prize winners in chemistry, medicine, and physics in the past two decades have been immigrants. Uncertainties about immigration for tech jobs, reflected by the internal strife in the Trump team and among its supporters, could result in fractured policymaking, with foreign-born STEM workers getting placed under the same anti-immigrant policymaking umbrella as undocumented immigrants. In the fusillades of the MAGA Civil War, Trump took Musk's side, saying he has always been a big backer of H-1Bs, although the president has previously said the opposite. He once called the visas very, very bad for workers. In fact, during Trump's first term, his administration set up a partial H-1B blockade. The denial rate for the already short supply of the visas reached 24% in fiscal year 2018. It fell back to 2% in fiscal year 2022 after courts found his administration's handling of these visas to be unlawful. Cutting off the flow of foreign workers by rejecting H-1B applications can negatively affect and impact local economies and even hurt U.S. workers. In one 2014 study, researchers looking at this issue found that cities across the nation with high H-1B denial rates experienced a drop in computer-related jobs, and this decline was accompanied by lower wage growth for native-born citizens who lived there. The U.S. remains a prime destination for foreign-born students and professionals, but the status quo may not hold. Talent recruitment programs began to emerge in many countries in the 2010s. One prime example is Canada's Tech Talent Strategy, which afforded three-year work permits to as many as 10,000 people in the U.S. who have H-1B visas. The ultimate fix for the U.S.'s chronically broken immigration system would be to implement a long-sought massive overhaul through congressional legislation. Such comprehensive immigration reform would rationalize the competing demands of border security and the need to equitably regulate both legal and illegal immigration. But this kind of all-encompassing measure has little chance of being adopted during the next 4 years. In bringing wide attention to the role of legal immigration, the wrangling over H-1Bs may have an upside. On a podcast last year, the president remarked that international college students, once they graduate, should be eligible for green cards, which confer permanent residency. His administration could make good use on some variation of this idea. Other steps might raise the caps on H-1B visas granted annually, currently 85,000 in total, and institute much-needed reforms to the visa program, especially to ensure that visa holders are not exploited. Employers could do their part by seeking out underutilized programs, such as the O-1A temporary work visa for individuals with extraordinary ability. If nothing is done on H-1Bs and other legal immigration measures, the desirability of the U.S. as a destination for STEM students and tech workers will fade. The 2024 NSA report notes that between 2019 and 2023, the U.S. fell from first to eighth worldwide in scores for attractiveness to highly educated workers. It will probably slip further. The anti-immigrant atmosphere ushered in by the Trump administration's promised mass deportation of undocumented immigrants is also likely to sour foreign students and engineers on coming to the U.S., and this outcome will benefit no one. And this opinion and analysis from the Scientific American Board of Editors appears under Science Agenda in the March 2025 issue of Scientific American. from the May 2025 issue of Scientific American, in the department The Universe, written by Phil Plait. Will an asteroid hit Earth? Astronomers pay close attention to potentially dangerous space rocks. You've no doubt seen this kind of news headline. Astronomers say space rock may hit Earth in the not-too-distant future! We usually get such warnings about one or two objects every year. The latest iteration concerns an asteroid, 2024 YR4, that is estimated to be more than 50 meters wide. For a while, there was a several percent chance of its impacting Earth, but after more observations, by the end of February 2025, an impact had essentially been ruled out. But how can anyone know such things? How do astronomers find these asteroids and then determine where they'll be many years into the future? We've actually known how to do this for centuries, thanks to German astronomer Johannes Kepler, who first figured out the requisite orbital laws in the 17th century. Since that time, the advent of better telescopes, digital cameras, and fast computers has made the task much easier, though by no means foolproof. There are around a dozen currently operating survey-type telescopic observatories that take wide-angle images of the sky every night and look for undiscovered objects zipping through our solar system. Seen from Earth, such objects appear to move relative to the far more distant fixed stars. Astronomers used to look for such motions by eye with photographs, but automation can now perform this task far faster and more accurately. Once a new moving object is found, its orbit needs to be determined. Is it on a circular path out past Mars, or does it have an elliptical orbit that brings it closer to Earth? This is where Kepler and his laws come in. He figured out that all orbits have one of three shapes: elliptical, parabolic, or hyperbolic. A circle is just an ellipse where the long and short axes are equal, so we lump circles in with ellipses. Parabolic and hyperbolic orbits are what we call open, meaning they don't close back on themselves. An object on an orbit like that is just passing through. It's moving rapidly enough to escape the sun's gravity and disappear into interstellar space. Most comets that fall in toward the sun from beyond Neptune, have nearly parabolic orbits. Only two objects have ever been found on extremely hyperbolic orbits: Oumuamua and the comet 2I Borisov. But an object in an elliptical orbit is bound to the sun and should orbit it indefinitely, unless it gets a gravitational kick from a planet, say. Our ability to predict a sun-orbiting object's future position comes from understanding everything we can about its ellipse. The basic characteristics of an orbital ellipse are its size, mathematically half the length of its long axis, a measurement called the semi-major axis, its eccentricity, which essentially measures how elliptical it is. Zero is circular and one is infinitely stretched out, like a line, and its orientation in space. An object's orbital ellipse can be tipped relative to that of Earth, for example, with its long axis pointed in some particular direction in space. Once we know all these parameters, called the orbital elements, we can mathematically define the associated ellipse. If we also know an asteroid's position along its ellipse, say on the date it was discovered or at a specific time during a subsequent observation, Kepler's equations tell us where along its orbit the asteroid should be on any given day. Well, in theory. In practice, it's not so easy. Forecasters usually need at least three well-separated observations of an asteroid to start nailing down all the variables governing the ellipse's shape. And those observations are not exact. Asteroids don't look like perfect tiny dots in an image, but instead are smeared out a bit, making it hard to know their precise position as they shift against the background stars. Such imprecisions may be small, but they add up. Thus, the result usually isn't an ideal ellipse, and the calculated path of the asteroid is fuzzy. In reality, its position might be a bit off from the predicted location. The further into the future, or past for that matter, you try to calculate the position, the worse the prediction gets. It's like the actual path of the asteroid is a cone with its vertex at the present position, opening up toward the direction in which you're trying to make predictions. Statistically speaking, the rock could be anywhere inside that cone, and that can add up to a large volume of space. The only way to narrow that path down is to get more observations, either fresh from telescopes or retroactively found in archival data. Also, the longer an object is observed, the more certain its orbital element measurements become. It's like being an outfielder in a baseball game. Imagine the pitcher throws the ball, but 1 second after the batter hits it, you have to close your eyes and guess where it will be so you can catch it. You can make a decent estimation, but it won't be anywhere near accurate enough to guide you. You must be able to keep your eye on the ball and watch as it moves to maximize your chances of making the catch. So we aim to observe asteroids for as long as possible to increase the temporal baseline of observations. There are obstacles, though. Some asteroids are small and decrease in brightness rapidly as the distance between them and Earth increases. This is the case for 2024 YR4, which is now moving away from Earth and forecasted to fade from view in late April, which means it would have happened a couple of months ago. Asteroids can also avoid observation by getting so close to the sun in the sky that they can't be seen for several months. Assuming, however, that an asteroid's orbit is well constrained and predictable, how do we know what the odds are of an Earth impact? Now we're getting to the important question. There are many methods for calculating this likelihood. One way is to simulate the orbit and note the dates when the object is in Earth's orbital vicinity, then determine whether our planet will be in its path at the same time. If so, well, that's bad, but not necessarily catastrophic. Earth is a small target, and the statistical volume of space the asteroid can be in on that date is usually large. Even for an apparently alarming asteroid, there's only a chance we'll get hit, and it's usually very low, especially the further in advance we try to predict it. There's only a chance we'll get hit, and it's usually very low. Typically, the odds of impact for any newfound potentially Earth-threatening space rock are one in thousands. In most cases, better observations nail down the path and show that it passes well away from Earth, and the odds drop effectively to zero. Irritatingly, the statistical chance of impact sometimes increases first, which is what happened with 2024 YR4. Remember, the asteroid is somewhere near the vertex of a large cone, and we don't know where. If Earth is near the cone's center line, then as the cone narrows with better observations, we're still inside it. The chance of impact goes up. But then, almost always, the cone narrows further and winds up pointing in a slightly different direction, leaving Earth safely outside it. And we can all breathe a sigh of relief. That's not to say we never get hit. Examples abound, such as the Chelyabinsk asteroid that exploded over Russia in 2013, the Tunguska event in Siberia in 1908, and the impact that formed Arizona's meteor crater 50,000 years ago. Every day, Earth plows through roughly 100 tons of interplanetary material, the vast majority of which is composed of tiny rocks that wind up as lovely meteors streaking across our sky. But sometimes those chunks of debris are bigger, much bigger. The bigger they get, the rarer they become, so truly devastating impacts are few and far between. They do happen, though, so we must keep our eyes on the sky. The good news is that even more telescopes are coming online, including the huge Vera C. Rubin Observatory in Chile and NASA's NEO Surveyor, planned for launch in 2027. And they should help us not just map where these objects are and where they're headed, but also determine their size and what they're made of. If some asteroid big enough to do damage has us in its crosshairs, we hope we'll know about it as soon as we can. giving us enough time, perhaps, to do something about it. The more telescopes we have covering the greater amount of sky over time, the better. And this reassuring article about whether or not an asteroid will hit Earth was written by Phil Plate. And in this same issue of Scientific American, Mark Fischetti gives us another glimpse of history 50, 100, and 150 years ago. First, from 1975, introducing the video disc. A video disc system that presents recorded pictures and sound on a television set will be put on the market next year by North American Philips Corporation and MCA Inc. The player looks somewhat like a phonograph, and the record resembles a phonograph record. The distinctive feature is an optical stylus, which replaces the needle of the phonograph. The stylus is a scanner employing a 1 milliwatt helium neon laser as its sensor. The record is not touched by the playing device and therefore will not wear out or deteriorate. The optical stylus also makes it possible to pick out randomly part of a record for display, to run a scene in reverse or in slow motion, and to view a film frame by frame. The companies plan to sell the player for about $500 and the records for $2 to $10, depending on their length and content, which could include motion picture films, instructional films, sports events, and news reels. Also from 1975, a giant eye for extraterrestrials. Cyclops, an array of 1,500 radio antennas, each 100 meters in diameter, has been proposed by a NASA-sponsored study as a tool for detecting signals from extraterrestrial civilizations. The antennas would be connected to one another and to a large computer system. The effective signal collecting area would be hundreds of times greater than that of any existing radio telescope and would be capable of detecting even such weak signals as the internal radio frequency communications of a civilization as far away as several hundred light years. A note, the proposed Project Cyclops was shelved because of high anticipated costs. 100 years ago in 1925, first, colored lights reveal speeding. An idea has been suggested for a signal plate firmly attached to a car bearing three or four differently colored lights. These would be attached to the speedometer so that the white light, for example, would burn when the speed was 10 to 15 miles an hour, the blue light between 15 and 30 miles per hour, the red at 40 miles per hour, and so on. If any officer or citizen saw a car running on a street and burning a red light, that would be sufficient evidence that the speed limit was being exceeded to a dangerous extent. Something has to be done to make our streets safer. Island universes. Thousands of universes, each similar to the galaxy of stars of which our sun is an insignificant member, with the nearest universe so distant that its light travels for a million years before it reaches us, have been shown to exist by Edwin P. Hubble of the Mount Wilson Observatory. Through telescopes, these universes appear to be clouds of light, more or less with a spiral structure. By means of variable stars in these galaxies, the distance of a few has been determined, and in the opinion of Harlow Shapley, director of the Harvard College Observatory, this proves the theory that they are island universes lying entirely outside our own system. Edwin P. Hubble would undoubtedly be very pleased to know that the space telescope named after him has just observed its 35th year birthday. The longevity of the Hubble Space Telescope is thanks in large part to a series of five missions to repair and update components from 1993 to 2009, and it is still revolutionizing astronomy. Also from 1925, old-time graffiti. Human nature is a pretty constant thing. Archaeologists digging in the ruins at Saqqara have found columns which were once part of an ancient Egyptian temple. Over 3,000 years ago, it was already a showplace, a sort of Washington Monument of the time. On the columns are scribbled names and comments, written there by visitors of 30 centuries ago, just as people write their names and addresses on the walls of public buildings today. And from 150 years ago in 1875, balloon deaths. Croce Spinelli and Seville, two French aeronauts, have laid down their lives in the cause of science. With M. Gaston Tissandier, they attempted to ascend to a higher altitude than had ever been reached, to make experiments for carbonic acid, conduct spectroscopic observations, and in general obtain data. It was believed possible by inhaling oxygen from a respirator. At 29,000 feet elevation, all three men became unconscious. The balloon soared higher and higher and then descended. Tissandier regained his senses on reaching respirable air, to find his companions dead from suffocation. And this peek at history, 50, 100, and 150 years ago, appears in the May 2025 issue of Scientific American. The following article comes from Ars Technica, posted on January 20th, 2025. Robotic hand helps pianists overcome ceiling effect. Passive training with robotic exoskeleton hand even led to motor improvements in the untrained hand. When it comes to fine-tuned motor skills like playing the piano, practice, they say, makes perfect. But expert musicians often experience a ceiling effect, in which their skill level plateaus after extensive training. Passive training using a robotic exoskeleton hand could help pianists overcome that ceiling effect, according to a paper published in the journal Science Robotics. "I'm a pianist, but I injured my hand because of overpracticing," co-author Shinichi Furuya of Kabushiki Keisha Sony Computer Science Kenkyūjō told New Scientist. "I was suffering from this dilemma between overpracticing and the prevention of the injury, so then I thought, I have to think about some way to improve my skills without practicing." Recalling that his former teacher used to place their hands over his to show him how to play more advanced pieces, he wondered if he could achieve the same effect with a robotic hand. So Furuya et al. Used a custom-made exoskeleton robot hand capable of moving individual fingers on the right hand independently, flexing and extending the joints as needed. Per the authors, prior studies with robotic exoskeletons focused on simpler movements, such as assisting in the movement of limbs, stabilizing body posture, or helping grasp objects. That sets the custom robotic hand used in these latest experiments apart from those used for haptics in virtual environments. A helping robot hand. A total of 118 pianists participated in three different experiments. In the first, 30 pianists performed a designated chord trill motor task with the piano at home every day for 2 weeks. First, simultaneously striking D and F keys with the right index and ring fingers, then striking the E and G keys with the right middle and little fingers. "We used this task because it has been widely recognized as technically challenging to play quickly and accurately," the authors explained. "It appears in such classical pieces as Chopin's Etude Opus 25, No. 6, Maurice Ravel's Ondine, and the first movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 3. A photo shows a hand exoskeleton robot attached to the digits of the right hand. The device can flex and extend the metacarpophalangeal joints of the individual digits. The pianist performed the task at a tempo of 80 BPM, or beats per minute, for 10 seconds, followed by a 10-second rest for 30 sessions. After 2 weeks, they were assigned to one of two laboratory groups, in which the robot exoskeleton hand passively moved those four fingers for 30 minutes to perform the chord trill, faster than the players could do so themselves. This was followed by a post-test session in which the pianist played the chord trill twice for 5 seconds, as quickly and accurately as possible. The second experiment was designed to pinpoint the elements of movement that led to the enhanced motor skills, involving 60 pianists randomly assigned to one of 5 groups and getting different interventions. The results: even when the skill plateaued after weeks of piano practice, passive training of the fast and complex motor skill with the robot further facilitated the maximum rate of repetitive piano keystrokes involving fast and complex multi-finger movements, the authors wrote. And the training effect also showed up in the untrained hand, so there was an intermanual transfer effect. In other words, the hand exoskeleton allows skilled individuals to achieve otherwise impossible motions and is thus an effective way to overcome the ceiling effect. A third experiment aimed to assess any changes in neuroplasticity in the corticospinal system during passive training. This involved 28 pianists undergoing the same lab-based protocol as the first experiment, while undergoing electromyographic, or EMG, monitoring and stimulated regions of the motor cortex associated with finger movements before and after training sessions. Only the hand trained by the exoskeleton showed pattern changes in multi-finger movements, which the authors suggest is evidence of neuronal adaptation from the passive training. More research is needed into why the untrained hand also showed improved motor skills. The authors acknowledge that participants were limited by the risk of muscular fatigue. For instance, one experiment involved 5 trials in which pianists played as fast as they could at the maximum rate for 10 seconds, but players found it difficult to do so for longer periods or for more than 10 trials. Still, the authors believe their study highlights the importance of embodying otherwise impossible skills using augmentation technology, such as a robotic exoskeleton. It could also prove useful for rehabilitation of certain neurological disorders that affect manual dexterity. And this article was posted on January 20th, 2025. Science also meets culture in this next article from the November 2024 issue of Scientific American. Under Forum, we learn how science upstaged climate denial. A play celebrates the agreement that opened nations worldwide to accepting the science of climate change. By Ben Santer. It's a very strange experience to watch a play in which you are a character and to shake hands with the person who plays you. I did both this past July 2024 while attending a performance of Kyoto at the Swan Theatre in Stratford-upon-Avon in England. The moment meant more, of course, than just a glimpse of oneself on history's stage. The play shows how science won out over climate denial in a critical face-off between scientists and industry over the future of the planet. Kyoto is about the Kyoto Protocol, an agreement made more than 25 years ago that, as summarized by the United Nations, committed industrialized countries and economies in transition to limit and reduce greenhouse gases, GHG, emissions, in accordance with agreed individual targets. Written by Joe Murphy and Joe Robertson, the play provides a dramatic retelling of an historic meeting in December 1997 in Kyoto, Japan, where the protocol was finalized. At this meeting, a key intergovernmental panel on climate change, IPCC, Scientific Assessment, helped to inform the international emissions reduction negotiations. The Working Group 1 part of the IPCC Second Assessment Report, which was completed in 1995 and published in early 1996. I was convening lead author of Chapter 8, Detection of Climate Change and Attribution of Causes. The role of the IPCC back in 1995 and today was to advise the governments of the world on the science and negative impacts of climate change, as well as on strategies for mitigating and adapting to those impacts. In 1990, the first IPCC scientific assessment had concluded that the jury was still out in whether a human-caused climate change signal could be identified in real-world climate data. The 1995 assessments chapter reached a very different conclusion, encapsulating in 12 simple words. The balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate. This was a momentous statement from cautious scientists and a rather conservative organization. Multiple factors contributed to this dramatic transition. Advances in the science of climate fingerprinting, for example, made a big difference in climate research during the 5 years between the two reports. Fingerprinting seeks to identify the unique signatures of different human and natural influences on Earth's climate. This uniqueness becomes apparent if we probe beyond a single number, such as the average temperature of Earth's surface, including land and oceans, and look instead at complex patterns of climate change. Patterns have discriminatory power and allow scientists to separate the signature of human-caused fossil fuel burning from the signatures of purely natural phenomena, such as El Niño and La Niña climate patterns, changes in the sun's energy output, and effects of volcanic eruptions. Kyoto describes some of the fingerprint evidence that was presented during a key meeting in Madrid in November 1995, ahead of the Kyoto face-off dramatized in the performance. The discernible human influence on global climate conclusion was finalized in Madrid, where the participants included 177 delegates from 96 countries, representatives from 14 non-governmental agencies, and 28 lead authors of the IPCC Second Assessment Report. As a lead author of the evidence chapter, I was there among them in that Madrid plenary room. So were several of the other characters in Kyoto, including the play's central one, Donald Perlman, who was a lawyer and lobbyist for the Climate Council, a consortium of energy interests. Perlman and I were on opposite sides of the Madrid chessboard. My efforts were directed toward synthesizing and assessing complex science and ensuring that the science was accurately represented in the IPCC report. His were directed toward delaying international efforts to reduce emissions of heat-trapping greenhouse gases. Such reductions were bad for the business interests he represented and for the revenues of oil-producing countries such as Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. Perlman, who died in 2005, understood the singular importance of the Madrid discernible human influence conclusion. He knew it was the scientific writing on the wall. The jury was no longer out. Human-caused fingerprints had been identified in records of Earth's surface and atmospheric temperatures. Humans were not innocent bystanders in the climate system. They were active participants. Burning fossil fuels had changed the chemistry of Earth's atmosphere, thereby warming the planet and sending Earth's vital signs into concerning territory. The Madrid conclusion meant the days of unfettered fossil fuel use and carbon pollution were numbered. It also made Perlman's lobbying job more difficult. His response was to attack the science and the scientists as part of a rearguard action to delay international agreement on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. As Perlman's character explains in Kyoto, it was a deliberate scorched earth strategy. Torch the science and the scientists. I experienced this strategy firsthand in a memorable personal meeting with Perlman in Washington, D.C. on May 21, 1996. After I spoke at the U.S. Congress's Rayburn House office building about the scientific evidence for human fingerprints on global climate, Perlman confronted me and started screaming at me, literally screaming. He expressed outrage at what he claimed were unauthorized changes to the chapter I had been responsible for. The changes had in fact been authorized by the IPCC, as Perlman knew very well. He had been present at the Madrid meeting where the changes were discussed. Ultimately, he lost. Despite tremendous differences among countries in terms of their national self-interest, culpability for the problems of human-caused climate change, and vulnerability to the effects of climate change, an international agreement was finally reached. The 1997 Kyoto Protocol commits participating countries to a common goal: reducing greenhouse gas emissions and avoiding dangerous anthropogenic interference in Earth's climate system. Kyoto is the dynamic story of how that agreement was achieved. In one memorable line in the play, Perlman's wife, Shirley, asks him, "Are we on the wrong side?" The question is prompted by an exposé of Perlman's lobbying activities in the German news magazine Der Spiegel. Shirley wants to know whether her husband's efforts to cast doubt on the climate change science and on the scientists involved in advancing that science place them on the wrong side of history. The Perlman character in the play responds, "No, Shirley, we're not on the wrong side." But Perlman and the industries he represented were on the wrong side of the science. Nearly 30 years after the Madrid IPCC meeting, and after Perlman's concerted efforts to undercut climate science, human fingerprints on Earth's climate are now unequivocal and ubiquitous. The cautious 1995 discernible human influence finding has been confirmed and strengthened by all four subsequent IPCC assessments. The scientists in Madrid got it right. Perlman and his employers were also on the wrong side of history. Today, 191 countries have ratified the Kyoto Protocol. Although the U.S. Congress never did ratify it, the protocol helped to pave the way for the 2016 Paris Agreement. The serious consequences of human-caused global warming are now manifest to all, building momentum for real action to cut carbon pollution. The days of climate science denial are numbered. But they are not quite over yet. Another Donald, former President Donald Trump, and of course now President, has repeatedly denied the reality and seriousness of climate change. It's no surprise that his backers look a lot like Perlman's. There is a very small probability that Trump will ever watch Kyoto. There's an even smaller probability that Trump will consider whether he, too, is on the wrong side of science and history. Sadly, he is. Trump's return to the U.S. presidency would reprise Perlman's heyday, when manufactured doubts obscured mature scientific understanding. Since the writing and publication of this article, Trump did indeed return to the White House and is promoting doubt regarding scientific understanding. In 2016, the U.S. did sign the Paris Agreement and committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And then, in 2021, after withdrawing under President Trump in 2020, it rejoined. However, in 2025, the U.S. announced its intent to again withdraw from the agreement. Kyoto tells the story of how that scientific understanding evolved and how powerful vested interests tried to destroy it. It is absolutely vital to give that account today, with the bill for climate change coming due all around us. I hope Kyoto reaches audiences I could never dream of reaching through all scientific papers I've ever written, and I hope it provides us with what mathematicians call an existence principle, proof that something difficult is possible. The existence principle in Kyoto is that humanity can come together and solve a seemingly intractable problem. This commentary in Forum in the November 2024 issue of Scientific American was written by Ben Santer. Next, we turn to the March 2025 issue of Science News, an article written by Jenny Crumrine. She is a freelance writer, and her kids are obsessed with puffins. So when her brother mentioned a puffling rescue operation in Iceland, she was all in. For her photo essay about the Puffling Patrol, she traveled to an island off the coast of Iceland. There are at least three pronunciations of this island: Heimaey, Heimaey, and Heimaey. The freelance writer Jenny Crumrine was impressed by the people's devotion. Some nights, near-freezing wind scoured the island, making it hard to walk, yet lots of people were out searching for pufflings for hours. Her article, Patrolling for Puffins, A Community in Iceland Helps Wayward Birds Find the Sea, and Helps Scientists, Too. A small, rocky island off Iceland is home to the world's largest breeding colony of Atlantic puffins. When breeding season is in full swing, around 1.5 million adults pair up and nestle into burrows on the grassy seaside slopes above Heimaey Island's rocky cliffs. Once chicks hatch, puffin moms and dads devote about 6 weeks to caring for their babies, bringing meals of small fish and fending off predators such as seagulls. By late August or early September, the pufflings are mature enough to live on their own. Over 4 to 5 weeks, throngs of young birds head off to sea. Their instinct is to head for the open ocean, where they will spend most of their lives. They leave in the dark of night to hide from predators, guided by the moon. But sometimes fledglings lose their way. Heimaey's only town got electricity about a century ago. Ever since, dazzled by night lights or swept along in stiff sea breezes, some young puffins have taken a wrong turn toward town. Light pollution affects wildlife in perilous ways, disrupting crucial activities from pollination to mating. Some creatures, like these Atlantic puffins, lose their orientation and can't find their way to the ocean. Some could be attacked by predators. Others might starve. Fortunately for these pufflings, the residents of Heimaey have taken a hands-on approach to addressing the problem. The community-based Puffling Patrol searches for and rescues birds that have gone astray. These chicks and colony adults are helping scientists study puffins' largely mysterious lives at sea. Parents care for immature pufflings until they can fly off on their own. The downy fluff around this puffling's neck that is shown in a photo shows that it's not yet ready to fledge. Pufflings leave the burrow under the cover of night and head to the sea, but artificial light can disorient them. To the rescue. Equipped with flashlights, cardboard boxes, and gloves, folks head out after dark searching for lost chicks. They scour backyards, parking lots, and rooftops, and gas stations, wherever the bright glow of town competes with moonlight. On any given night during puffling season, a dozen or more small groups and individuals may be patrolling the town. Rescuing stranded birds is a long-standing tradition on this island, though the catchy Puffling Patrol name has been around for only a decade or so. Typically, teens or younger kids scour the night alongside parents or grandparents who pass down the tradition. For the little ones, it's a great excuse to stay up late. Puffins dive from the sea surface to nab food. They zip through the water as if they're flying, but adaptations that enhance swimming, such as a stubby wingspan, come at the expense of takeoff ability, which leaves them vulnerable to cats and other predators on land. On the upside, the birds are easy to catch. Usually it takes just a short chase to grab one. The bird is put in a cardboard box and taken home. People are asked to weigh their rescued pufflings and log them on the Puffling Patrol website. The only thing to watch out for are the pufflings' tiny kitten-like claws. The patrol often takes healthy rescues, those large enough to live at sea, to the cliffs. From this height, the birds can catch some air. They'll fly as far as they're able before landing in the water, perhaps 50 meters or more. The farther, the better. Some pufflings need a helpful boost, a push, off the clifftop, while others take the initiative on their own. And we see one member of the Puffling Patrol with a beautiful ocean just out of reach as she stands on the cliff and releases a puffling. Some rescues, however, need extra care. While wandering around town, pufflings sometimes fall into the harbor and end up slick with oil from the local passenger ferry, from cargo ships, and from fishing boats. Dirtied feathers must be cleaned to become waterproof again. Otherwise, the birds would not survive in the frigid North Atlantic. Other pufflings may be injured or underfed, and some may have left home too early, before growing their adult plumage. These birds are taken to the Puffin Rescue Center in Haumea, run by the global nonprofit Sea Life Trust. There's even a drop box for after-hour arrivals, where pufflings will remain safe through the night. During the 2024 season, the Puffling Patrol rescued more than 4,200 pufflings. That's approximately one bird for every human on Haumea. Life at sea. For about 420 of the rescued birds, scientists put a ring on the puffin's legs. It's an ID band, allowing researchers to document a bird's location each time it's sighted and to monitor their population. Adult puffins develop a brightly colored striped beak and orange feet. This adult appearance does not change much, aside from the beak color getting brighter during breeding season. So the only way to know a puffin's exact age by sight is if it's been tagged. With the rings, scientists have learned puffins can live at least 40 years. The birds spend most of their lives in the open ocean. Observing birds at sea is nearly impossible, so much about puffins remains a mystery. Ecologists like Erpur Snare Hansen, who leads a team at the South Island Nature Research Center, are curious to know how far puffins roam and where they go. Each June, Hansen and colleagues briefly capture adults at their burrows, while also checking on eggs, and fit them with battery-operated global location sensors. These geolocators detect changes in daylight, which can be analyzed to pinpoint a bird's location within about 180 kilometers. On Haumea, only adult birds are currently tagged with these GLS devices, but other researchers in Scandinavia have begun tracking juveniles as well to learn about their movements after fledging. For about a decade, Hansen and other researchers have contributed GLS data to SeaTrack, a project that tracks seabirds. The data are revealing what seabirds do offshore, why there are fewer and fewer of them, and what humans can do to help them survive. In Europe, where more than 90% of Atlantic puffins reside, the species is listed as endangered. The European population of about 7.8 million birds is projected to decrease by 50 to 79% between 2000 and 2065, within three puffin generations. Puffins face a variety of threats. One of their main food sources is sand eels, a group of slender fish with an eel-like appearance. Sand eel populations are shrinking due to climate change and industrial-scale overfishing. Puffins must compete with other sea life and trawlers for dwindling numbers of these and other forage fish. When sand eels become scarce, puffins must work harder to find them. Puffins stressed this way often produce fewer chicks. Another threat is pollution, including mercury, plastics, and contaminants from shipping. Bird migration studies using SeaTrack data have identified sites in the North Atlantic where restricting human activity and prioritizing pollution cleanup efforts could have a big impact. For instance, there's a vital feeding ground for about 5 million seabirds, including puffins and 20 other species, in the middle of the Atlantic. Species from at least 56 colonies, spanning 16 countries and regions, come to this area during the vulnerable molting period, when birds shed worn-out feathers. In 2021, a European consortium called the OSPAR, O-S-P-A-R, Convention, declared this spot a marine protected area, the North Atlantic Current and Evlonoff Seamount. It's the first such area identified by tracking data. Waiting for a homecoming. Once puffling season ends and burrows empty out, Haumea's seaside cliffs go quiet. Members of the puffling patrol catch up on lost sleep and share their favorite picks. At the end of the 2024 puffling season, three rescues couldn't be released and now live in an enclosure at the Puffin Rescue Center, where visitors can watch their antics. Meanwhile, Iceland's puffin researchers wait patiently for the bird's summer return. Adult puffins return to the same colony, even the same burrow, year after year. With the data collected from these birds, Hansen and other scientists will weave together the story of each wanderer's ocean journey. And we see a puffin in flight. The range of Atlantic puffins spans the North Atlantic from the coasts of Canada and the northeastern United States to Greenland and Russia. The birds spend most of their time at sea, returning to land only during breeding season. And in several other pictures, first we see a bird in a cardboard box. When members of the puffling patrol discover a wayward bird, they put it in a cardboard box to bring home, and then we see that they get weighed. Birds that are healthy enough will be brought back to Haumea's seaside cliffs for release. One of the staff members at the Puffin Rescue Center gives one puffling a boost toward the sea as she releases it from a cliff. And as this article mentioned, to help monitor the puffin population, various researchers will put an ID ring on a rescued puffling's leg. In the photo, we see research assistant Lucas Canas Hernandez putting the ring on the puffling as he has it caught between his legs inside a tube. In the future, if scientists come across the bird again, they'll know how old it is because they know when they attached the ID ring. And this article on the Puffling Patrol was written by Jenny Crumrine. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona.